Hi, this is Dr. Michelle Woolhouse. Join us on FX Medicine next week, where we'll be talking to Jessica Turton to discuss the use of continuous glucose monitoring for optimizing metabolic health. Subscribe to us on your favorite podcast app and follow us on social media to make sure you never miss an episode.
Welcome to FX Medicine by Bioceuticals, where we bring you the latest in evidence-based, integrative, functional, and complementary medicine. We begin today by acknowledging the traditional custodians of land, on which we gather and pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and emerging. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples here today, and wherever you are listening from. I'm Emma Sutherland, and today I'm thrilled to be joined by my co-hosts for a panel discussion on the complex topic of cardiometabolic health. I'm joined by my fellow FX Medicine ambassadors, Dr. Adrian Lopresti, Lisa Costabia, Dr. Michelle Woolhouse, and Mick Alexander. Welcome, everyone.
Hi, Emma.
Hi, Emma.
Hello. Hello, everyone.
As integrated health practitioners, we understand the body is not just a collection of parts. It's a finely tuned, interconnected whole. And nowhere is that more evident than in the way metabolic health impacts every single cell, every tissue, every system in the body. From your brain to your bones, your hormones to your heart, your skin to your sleep, cardiometabolic health is the foundation beneath it all. In part one, we are going to bust some myths, look at the pathophysiology involved in cardiometabolic disease, then go through the exact assessment measures we use in our very own clinics. Finally, we will uncover some cardiometabolic hijackers, factors you may be missing from your clinical practice. In part two, we will discuss treatment options, not only traditional treatment options, but also the treatments each of us have discovered throughout our clinical expertise. And then we will bring these to life via a case study. We'll end with our favourite resources to use with patients. Great to have you all here. Now, Michelle, would you like to kick off part one for us and bust a myth?
Oh, I love busting myths, sure am. Well, I guess the myth that I want to bust is that there is no one size fits all when it comes to diet. And there was a really, really interesting study that was published in Nature in 2020, and it was called the PREDICT study, and that stands for Personal Response to Dietary Composition Trial. And it looked at about 1,000 people, including a lot of twins, in the UK, and they looked at like the postprandial measurements, which, you know, is the glucose measurements after all these different people ate identical foods. And they had a look at things like triglyceride levels, glucose levels, and insulin levels, and just found vastly different responses, and like by huge amounts actually. And so it's this kind of idea that an identical food choice has a different physiological response for different people. And that's really important to know because glucose responses do change and vary enormously. And a lot of people get very surprised. I mean, it's quite common for friends to kind of go, well, I eat exactly the same as my best friend or my sister or even a twin, and I have a different physiological response. And what they found when they looked into why that is that it's specific factors such as things like the gut biome. So the gut biome had a huge influence over this variance factor than did, say, the meal macronutrients. And so these genetic variants, you know, had a modest impact on the prediction, you know, of glucose, but up to like 10% changes in glucose responses in different people. So that is the myth that I want to bust, you know, that it isn't a one-size-fits-all diet, and therefore I guess a sense of personalization in terms of the responsiveness that you have can really be a game changer when we're looking at cardiometabolic health.
Fascinating, the difference in those glucose levels post eating the same meal. And it really just goes to show that personalization is absolutely essential when we advise on diets.
100%.
And Mick, what about you? What's a myth you'd like to bust for us?
Well, you know, a lot of people have said to me over the years, I've got big bones, or it's in my genes. I wish I had a dollar for every time someone said that to me. It's this kind of fatalistic attitude that, you know, such is life, I can't do much about it. Mm. So I thought, has there ever been a study about people that have, you know, that discovered or looked at, does big bones do make a difference, or do they make a difference, I should say? And there was a study in the UK. So it was a study of people that were getting hip replacements at a UK hospital. It was a four-year study with a little over 400 people. And what they did is they measured, when they went in for surgery, they measured their acetabular cup of their hip. And what they found was they found a very weak positive linear association with BMI, but there was no relationship between obesity and cup size. Mm. So I think in reality that myth's kind of a little busted, if you ask me. And then people talk about their genes, like I inherited dud genes. Well, there was a Chinese study, and it was a twin study, and this was in 2022, it was reported. And this looked at 1,421 pairs of Chinese twins over decades. So it was a huge data set. And it actually found that some cardiometabolic traits, things like BMI, HDL, LDL, triglycerides, and blood pressure, were in fact heritable. But the estimates ranged from around 30% in the case of HbA1c to around 72% for BMI, and that was in their early stages of life. But then things started to change as they got older. So we see that genetics make you more predisposed to cardiometabolic issues, but this effect declined with age, so we started to see environmental factors take over. For example, when you look at BMI, its heritability when they were younger was around 72%, but as they got older, that decreased down to around 60%, and it got lower and lower as they aged. So in older populations, and as we age, interventions targeting modifiable risk factors, things like hypertension, dyslipidemia, etc., they become crucial. So I guess the take-home message here is, you might get some dud genes, but in the end, you control your destiny.
Great message, Mick. I love that one. Lisa, what about you? What myth have you got for us?
Well, the myth that I wanted to dispel today is that cardiometabolic disease is an old person's disease. The reality is that even though cardiovascular disease is one of those topics we often associate with aging, the research shows us that it can actually start at a young age, much younger than most of us would realise, I think. So data obtained from the Australian Health Survey, which included over 2,000 young adults aged between 15 and 24, observed that approximately 14% were overweight or obese. Additionally, hypertension was also prevalent, with 24% of males hypertensive and 14% of young females hypertensive, which for me is a big surprise because it's not something I usually associate with this age group. Now, most of us would also see young women in clinic with insulin resistance as a result of PCOS or hypothyroidism, and we know that this insulin resistance is a risk factor for cardiometabolic disease later on in life. But most of our patients would have no idea about this when they come in and they're in their early 20s, that they're possibly going to get type 2 diabetes later on in life if they don't adjust these risk factors. So I think understanding and identifying risk factors like insulin resistance, obesity and hypertension in young adults early can help to modify cardiometabolic risk. And I think it also really brings up the importance of testing blood pressure, insulin and all those sorts of things in our younger patients, because if we identify this early, we can modify that risk. And again, I don't know if it's something that we always think of doing in our younger patients. So building upon this, what I also found really interesting in the research is that the studies show that young adults have lower health literacy of cardiovascular risk factors than I think most of us again assume. And I think, Mick, you might see some of this when you're doing point of care testing in the community. A systematic review of Australian adults aged between 18 and 34 years showed that only 33% identified hypertension as a cardiovascular risk factor. So that means 67% were unaware. 27% identified obesity. So again, 73% of young adults were unaware that obesity can increase risk of cardiometabolic disease. 49% identified stress, and only 55% identified diet and smoking as risk factors. So I think there's a lot to be done around education, and we can't just assume as practitioners that younger individuals know or understand understand what we think they might do about cardiometabolic disease.
Mm. Really interesting that 24% of males were hypertensive. So more young people are hypertensive, but they don't even see it as a risk factor themselves. Mm. And we as practitioners don't have it on our radar to check. So that's almost a threefold situation of bringing that to light. So thank you. The myth that I want to bust is if your BMI is normal, then your metabolic health is fine. I hear this all the time in clinic. Research using data from over 6,500 Australian adults between the ages of 18 and 69 showed that 14% of people had a normal, healthy BMI, but had central adiposity. And these individuals had a significantly increased risk of cardiovascular mortality. In fact, it was a staggering 87% higher risk. And we know that BMI alone does not rule out metabolic risks. People can have a healthy BMI, but still have metabolic dysfunction like insulin resistance, fatty liver, or hypertension. It's that classic tofu, thin on the outside, fat on the inside. And this is where we need to check things like waist circumference or fasting insulin, as I think they're better indicators than BMI alone. Adrian, do you have a myth you would like to dispel?
Yes, I want to dispel the myth that people with a heart condition should avoid exercise. Mm. So research shows that heart attack survivors who are regularly physically active live longer than those who don't. So certainly that's the case. And I'll just go through a couple of studies where they looked at people and followed them up over several years. There was one. It was the Swedish National Registry studies and comprised over 22,000 patients who had experienced a myocardial infarction. And they followed them up for 4.2 years. They had data comprising over 100,000 person years of follow-up. And during that time, there was just over 1,000 deaths recorded. And so what they did is they measured physical activity levels at 6 to 10 weeks post myocardial infarction and 10 to 12 months later. And they classified patients into constantly inactive. So at both time points they were inactive. There was another class they'll categorize as increased activity. So from time point one to time point two, their activity increased. There's the reduced activity who did the reverse. And then there was constantly active where they were active at both times, but there was no changes. And they wanted to look at kind of the hazard ratios calculated for mortality rates. And they controlled for several variables like quality of life, smoking and medication and so forth. And what they found was that compared to those who were constantly inactive, there were lower mortality rates during the first year post-myocardial infarction in constantly active people. So people who are active at both time periods, they had a 71% lower risk of mortality. Those who increased their activity from time point one to time point two had a 59% lower risk. And those who had reduced activity, so they were active at the first point, they were still active but less active in the second point, even they had a 44% lower risk of mortality. So certainly, definitely want to dispel that myth that people with cardiovascular disease should not exercise. And, you know, I'm just talking about mortality, but obviously there's the mental health benefits, there's the quality of life, there's the effect it has on sleep and energy. So definitely want to bust that myth.
I love that. 71% reduced mortality in people that stayed active after a heart attack. That's phenomenal and not that hard to do. Even daily walking would be so beneficial.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there was another study where they actually looked at walking, and people who walked more than 30 minutes a day, they had a 29% lower risk. And the faster they walked, the lower the mortality risk.
Oh, I love that. I'm going to tell my daughter that next time we're out walking together because she always complains at my fast pace. So let me just summarise this myth-busting section. Michelle, you talked about that, you know, no one-size-fits-all when it comes to diet strategies, as factors such as glucose response and the microbiome really highlight that need for the individualised approach. Mick, you definitely had it very straight there that blaming our genes or our big bones just doesn't cut it. Lisa, piece, you highlighted the incidence of cardiometabolic disease in the younger population, really dispelling the myth that cardiovascular disease only affects older people. I talked about the healthy BMI not always being so healthy because there can still be metabolic dysfunction underneath. And Adrian, you shared some great research on how safe and beneficial exercise is for cardiac patients. Now, we often see the end result of cardiometabolic disease, but what are the drivers that get us there in the first place? Let's take a moment to shine a light on the pathophysiology behind cardiometabolic disease. Adrian, what do you see as being most relevant here?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly would like to talk about the relationship between stress hormones and cardiovascular health. So we certainly know that stress, there's significant body of evidence that acute and chronic stress, you know, things like childhood trauma, work stress, social isolation, and even having like negative and emotional states such as depression and anxiety can influence the development of cardiovascular disease and may even trigger a cardiovascular event. So, and this is independent of all the classical cardiovascular risk factors like weight, smoking, blood lipids and things like that. So certainly there's a strong relationship between stress and cardiovascular disease. And there's been studies looking at the relationship between stress hormones such as cortisol and noradrenaline and their relationship with cardiovascular disease. And there was a meta-analysis of 33 studies with over 43,000 people, and what they found was that having higher levels of stress hormones, such as cortisol and norepinephrine, was associated with a higher risk of cardiovascular disease. And so compared with people with lower levels of stress hormones, people with the higher stress hormones had a 63% increased risk. And in actual fact, it was norepinephrine levels that had the most impact, and that was a 1.68 times increased risk. So definitely a relationship there. And there's also research showing that people with Cushing's syndrome, which is a condition characterised by chronic cortisol excess, they have a fourfold higher risk of cardiovascular disease mortality and have higher risk of complications associated with, you know, obesity, hypertension and things like that. So definitely there's a relationship between stress and cardiovascular disease. And cortisol in particular, I suppose there's a whole range of different mechanisms by where they affect cardiovascular disease. That they elevated cortisol can affect hyperlipidemia, so it can increase our blood lipids, and they can affect kind of plasma lipoprotein metabolism. It can lead to insulin resistance and hypoglycemia, so cortisol opposes the action of insulin. It affects our blood pressure and our hypertension, so certainly glucocorticoids can have a negative impact on our blood pressure. And stress hormones can also affect our abdominal adiposity too, so they have an impact there. And then also cortisol certainly has an effect on heart and blood vessels. So definitely I want to really highlight the relationship between stress and its impact on our cardiovascular health.
And I think stress is so nebulous in our patients. So it's something that we really need to remember that it's not just psychological impact. It's on that very cellular level that we're getting changes that increase that risk for cardiovascular disease. Lisa, what mechanisms do you see playing a part in cardiometabolic disease?
Well, we know that underlying cardiometabolic disease is a complex interplay involving insulin resistance, dysfunction of adipose tissue, endothelial dysfunction, and of course, chronic inflammation. What I think is really interesting is that sometimes these mechanisms that predispose to cardiometabolic disease can be due to another underlying condition causing the disease. So, for example, I spoke before about polycystic ovarian syndrome, and often when I'm looking at this condition, I'm teaching it as a female reproductive condition, with obviously it's an endocrine condition too. However, if we're thinking holistically about all the parts working together, long-term left unmanaged, as we spoke about before, that insulin resistance leads to fatty liver and type 2 diabetes, which can then predispose these women to cardiometabolic disease. Another example I see a lot of in my clinic is women coming in with hypothyroidism and simultaneous elevated blood lipids, hypertension, blood glucose issues. Research shows that these are not actually unrelated. Often practitioners might be trying to teach to manage the hypertension by itself or the lipids by itself, but we know that increases in ApoB containing lipoproteins, LDL-C, cholesterol are actually biochemical consequences of the hypothyroidism. So if we deal with the hypothyroidism, all the other factors clear up. Similarly, with hypothyroidism, we might see reduced pancreatic insulin secretion, which leads to that abnormal glucose regulation and insulin resistance. So I think it's really important to examine those underlying mechanisms like insulin resistance, inflammation, high cholesterol, and to understand that sometimes they're actually coming from a specific condition.
Mm. There is that low-hanging fruit between hypothyroidism and the mechanisms there, and it is something that I'm sure you see a lot in your patient demographic.
Mm. What are you seeing a lot of in your clinic, Em?
I think our lenses are also different, which is what I find fascinating. I tend to see mechanisms that involve the muscle and the bones, and it's not one that you think of immediately, but skeletal muscle isn't only about strength. It's a major metabolic organ, and muscle tissue plays a central role in insulin-mediated glucose disposal, in basal metabolic rate and resting energy expenditure, which all help to maintain that metabolic balance. A British Journal of Nutrition study from 2020 showed that men who had a lower skeletal muscle mass, even those with a normal BMI, were significantly more likely to have a metabolically unhealthy phenotype. So this shows how sarcopenia negatively affects metabolic health. And then when it comes to our bones, we have to remember that they're dynamic and metabolically active. Bone-derived hormones such as sclerostin and osteocalcin can really affect metabolism as they communicate with the pancreas, the liver, adipose tissue, and the muscle to influence insulin sensitivity, glucose uptake, and fat distribution. And lastly, bone-derived cytokines called osteokines play a bigger role in metabolism than we realise. A 2024 review mapped how osteokines correlate with components of metabolic syndrome like hyperglycemia, hypertension, dyslipidemia, and obesity. And it showed that elevated levels of osteokines are associated with an increased risk for type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and poor bone quality. So muscles and bones are so important and something that I feel we do tend to overlook a little bit. Mick, what are your thoughts on drivers for cardiometabolic disease?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest drivers is chronic kidney disease. There's a lot of it in the community, and it's got this bi-directional relationship with cardiovascular disease. Now, data from the Australian Bureau of Statistics in 2013 reported that around 11% of Australian adults had diagnosed signs of chronic kidney disease, but only 6.1% of these self-reported it on the survey. But there is some good news in this, and that's that most of these individuals only had stages 1 to 3 of kidney disease, with stages 1 to 2 being really quite low risk. And the other bit of good news is that the prevalence of chronic kidney disease in the global Australian community or the larger population has remained relatively steady over the last decade. It was around 0.8% in 2011-2012 and has remained at around 1% in 2022. So that's good news. Generally, though, the prevalence of chronic kidney disease jumps as we get older after the age of 64. Mm-hmm. And what we see is the cohort in that older age group, around 31% of the population over 64 actually have signs of biomedical chronic kidney disease. So, and when you look at the stats of the more severe cases, people with stages 3 to 5 of chronic kidney disease, around 88% of these were 65 years of age or older. So you would think it is generally a condition associated with ageing. Well, it may not quite be the case in Western Australia. In WA, the number of cases of chronic kidney disease have doubled from 2010, when they sat at around a little over 62,000 people, to 2020, where there were over 114,000 people. And it's estimated that around 4.8% of the Western Australian population now have stage 3 and worse chronic kidney disease. But what was even more surprising from that data set was that the age group with the highest annual increase were those people between the ages of 18 to 39, so not so much a young people's disease there. Interestingly, though, even mild kidney disease, and these are stages 1 to 3, can still carry a slightly higher risk of cardiovascular disease compared to the general population. And this is because they get into this systemic pro-inflammatory state. We see vascular calcification, and myocardial remodeling, and this mimics accelerated cardiovascular aging, that pattern of it. And this is because we see oxidative stress with endothelial cells and reductions in nitric oxide. So we see this vascular dysfunction occurring. And there can also be increases in cytokines, things like interleukin-6 and C-reactive protein. And we know that they feed into the process of atherosclerosis.
Complex interplay there, isn't there? I do like how you framed it as a bi-directional relationship, but it's very complex, the relationship between the kidneys and cardiovascular health, and one that we probably need to shine a bigger light on. Those statistics are quite shocking, especially the WA ones.
Yep.
Michelle, I'd love to hear your thoughts on drivers for cardiometabolic disease.
I've loved listening to this conversation about all the, I guess, pathophysiological, drivers. But I guess one of the things we need to really highlight here is the lifestyle factors and the lifestyle habits of modern-day Australians, and really we need to talk about alcohol here. Australians are huge drinkers, part of our kind of social elixir for many people. But a lot of the research is actually showing that women are drinking a lot more alcohol. So alcohol rates of consumption have actually sort of been quite steady in men of recent decades. But in women, there's actually been shown to have increased alcohol consumption. And alcohol is a very metabolically toxic agent, particularly the byproduct of alcohol. And it has a significant impact on not only our liver and our metabolism, but also direct impacts on our cardiovascular system as well. It's directly related to things like hypertension, central adiposity, but you can also have alcohol-related cardiomyopathy as well, and that can be reasonably quite common and something to kind of factor in when asking about lifestyle factors in patients too. And smoking, often in some of the more, I guess, educated cohorts, smoking rates have decreased, but it's certainly a big issue and it's had a bit of a resurgence in our younger population with the introduction of vaping and these cheaper cigarettes. And so we were seeing declines in smoking rates over the last few decades with really great public health messaging, but we're actually seeing that trend change again, which is a little bit frightening given the level of cardiometabolic or metabolic issues that we're seeing younger people too because of our food choices and our nutrition as well. So it's one thing to think about, and often I know in the younger population you might ask about smoking, but if they're vaping, they don't see that as smoking. So you really need to ask about vaping as well too. And so lifestyle factors are huge. Sedentary behaviour is enormous as well. Like when you look at what Australians are doing in terms of their work, we're either second or third longest working hours. We have the longest working hours amongst the longest in the world.
That is disappointing. And often most,
we've got this kind of like laconic kind of narrative that runs through Australians, in our kind of historical matrix, but I think we've really bucked the trend over the last kind of couple of decades. But yeah, we are. But most people's work life is about sedentary behaviour, sitting at computers, screen time, sitting in offices, and obviously longer commutes. So we've had a bit of a change in our demographics as well. And these kind of things really matter, how much we sit. And so there was huge research over the last kind of 5 or 7 years about the risk of just sedentary behaviour despite even exercise. So you could be doing exercise every day, but if you're sedentary throughout most of the day, that's an independent risk factor to the level of fitness. And that's something to really consider. And a lot of people are actually, advising you to kind of get up every hour and do some squats or some kettlebells or some, go upstairs and make a cup of tea, something like that. So, but, there's more. Sleep apnea is a huge issue. And we spoke a little bit, like Lisa's comment too, on these cardiometabolic risk factors in younger people. We're seeing sleep apnea in younger people, people with poor dentition or high arched palates, chronic sinus issues. If you've got sleep apnea, it can come across as either apneic or hypopneic, and we're seeing it even in younger girls as well. And around about 13 to even 20% of the population have some level of sleep apnea, and the research is really strong on its relationship to cardiometabolic health. So that is something, like, particularly with patients, like, think about sleep apnea, because your patients are not going to report it, you know, because often it's so chronic that they normalize it, and they normalize their fatigue levels or their brain function levels. And it's the one thing that you can really test for independently to whatever comes out into your history. I know Mick was reporting on the Australian Bureau of Statistics. I mean, have a look at the Australian Bureau of Statistics on low fruit and vegetable intake. It is mind-blowing how bad it is. I think only 1 in 4 children reach the recommended fruit and vegetable intake, and only 25% of, well, it's the same, you know, of adults. It's just extraordinary how bad our fruit and vegetable intake is in this country, despite the fact that we have excellent food accessibility. So it is enormous. I mean, I don't have to tell you guys, but the level of nutrition and fibre, you know, and antioxidants that you find in fruits and vegetables, and if you're not taking them in your diet, you know, it means that the body is not able to detoxify the toxins that are much more prevalent in our environment these days, let alone the toxins that we make from the byproducts of natural biology and physiology. I mean, there's so many lifestyle factors. I mean, my God, like, this is why we've got such an epidemic of cardiometabolic health. But Adrian mentioned stress, and I think, you know, I know so often in my clinical rooms that patients have come and reported stress and said, you know, do you think stress has got something to do with this? And they've gone to their cardiologist, and the cardiologist said nothing to do with it, just bad luck or whatever they've kind of said. But the research on hostility is really powerful here. And I think often as we normalise stress, particularly in our male cohort, that they actually understand the concept of hostility, and the role of hostility on cardiovascular disease is actually quite significant. And they find that people that high levels of hostility, either internal or externally expressed, had a much higher risk of heart attack, both in the acute and chronic aspects of cardiovascular disease. So talking to patients around hostility can actually be a really good idea, and using those different words to stress, because a lot of people say, I don't feel stressed at all. But in fact, when you talk about different words, you can kind of evoke a different interpretation of what you may be asking. And the last thing that I wanted to kind of really point out in terms of some of the drivers is this, you know, there's this growing incidence of atrial fibrillation, particularly in younger people. And it used to be seen in, you know, the over 65s, the over 75s, et cetera. So it was often seen as a kind of condition of aging. But we're seeing it a lot younger now, in 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds. And atrial fibrillation begets atrial fibrillation. So the more you go into it, the more you tend to go into it. So it's one of those things that, when treated early and treated well, it can really help reduce down the risk factors and the lifestyle factors that drive cardiovascular disease. We don't know a huge amount, from what I can kind of gather, about the absolute drivers of atrial fibrillation. There's certainly risk factors for alcohol. There's kind of questionable sort of risk factors around caffeine and sympathetic nervous system overdrive. But certainly that as an individual thing needs to be taken into consideration as well. And, yeah, so ask wide and long about lifestyle factors as the underlying drivers of cardiometabolic health.
Love that, Michelle. Thank you for sharing. So let me try and pull together a summary of all the drivers. Adrian, you discussed that multi-system impact of elevated cortisol levels and HPA axis activation, and shared a couple of amazing studies, which we'll put links to in the show notes. Lisa, you highlighted the role thyroid health plays. I talked about sarcopenia and osteopenia and how they can drive metabolic dysfunction. Mick, you really talked about that bidirectional relationship between kidney disease and cardiometabolic disease, and just that staggering stat of 31% of people over the age of 65 showing signs of kidney disease but not being aware of it, which is why we need to have it on our radar. And Michelle, goodness, you discussed the myriad of lifestyle factors. My favourite was actually that very strong link between metabolic health and sleep apnea, and how many of our patients will not even realise that it's going on for them. So another one that can go under the radar unless we shine a light on it. Now, the next step, team, is understanding how we assess cardiometabolic disease in clinical practice. Each of us brings years of hands-on experience to the conversation. So I would love to know your personal favourite ways of assessing cardiometabolic disease and what you see as being very useful. For me, I love using the simple tool of waist measurement. Our collective waistlines are expanding, with the latest stat saying the average waist measurement for adults was 95.1 centimetres. More than 2 in 3 Australian adults had a waist circumference that puts them at an increased risk for disease. And this has increased from 6 in 10 adults in 2011/2012. So we are growing the wrong way. Now, I want to bring up an interesting calculator that I use a lot, which is called the Body Roundness Index. We all know the problems with BMI, so I think a better tool to use is this Body Roundness Index. It's a simple online calculator that takes waist circumference, height, age, gender, and ethnicity into account. The scale runs from 1 to 16, and the higher the number, the more visceral adipose tissue. People with scores of 6.9 and above, which indicates wider, rounder bodies, were found to have a 49% higher risk of all-cause mortality compared to people having a BRI score of 5. Now, there is some good research on this calculator. A 2025 diabetology and metabolic syndrome cohort study in postmenopausal women with obesity demonstrated that BRI outperformed the Homer index for predicting metabolic syndrome. And then a 2025 study assessed nearly 6,000 adults and found that higher baseline BRI predicted new onset metabolic syndrome even after adjusting for traditional risk factors. So participants in the top BRI tertile had a significantly increased metabolic syndrome incidence versus the lowest tertile. And I think that the strength of the BRI is that it highlights the location of the fat, not just the amount, which is really critical. And I feel clinically it's more insightful than just weight or just BMI alone, as it provides a better sense of that invisible metabolic disruption, even in those who may appear to have normal weight. So waist circumference and the Body Roundness Index are my picks. Michelle, what do you use clinically to assess metabolic function?
I just want to say, Em, I love that too. I think the waist measurement is just such an important one.
Yeah.
But what I've been using in my clinical practice over the last couple of years is using a CGM, which stands for a continuous glucose monitor. And this has really been a game changer for both at a practitioner level but also at a patient level. And what the continuous glucose monitor does, it's a little device that sits on the back of your arm, and it records your continuous glucose stream over a 2-week period. So, you know, previous to these devices being available, we used to use fasting glucose or random glucose, you know, so it's a moment in time to actually, you know, look at somebody's glucose responsiveness. Or And obviously we had the glucose tolerance test where you drank 75 grams of glucose and then you tested it over a period of time and stuff, which was, well, it's disgusting to drink 75 grams of glucose. But still it only gives a one point in time. And so this is a really dynamic way to look at somebody's glucose levels over a 2-week period. And it's not only insightful for the practitioner, it's absolutely mind-blowing for the patient. And they can see their food choices and how they respond in real time. And in fact, the evidence and research has shown that it's a powerful tool for behaviour change. So about 90% in a study that came out in 2022, they found 90% of people that use the continuous glucose monitor felt that it contributed to a healthier lifestyle. Now, that's huge in terms of behaviour, because we know that behavioural change is just one of the most, well, it's the stickiest point in modern medicine. And 47% of people that were using this CGM reported more likely to go for a walk or do physical activity if they saw their blood glucose rise, you know, which is great in the era of Netflix and doom scrolling, you know, like getting out and going for a walk is, you know, when you see these kind of things. And 87% of CGM users felt that it modified their food choice based on the data from the CGM. So it's really, it's a really interesting marker to use clinically. And one of the things that it does is it gives you more information than the hemoglobin A1C, which is obviously looking at a person's glucose levels over a 2 to 3 month period. But it also gives you an indication of a marker that you can't get anywhere else called glucose variability. And this glucose variability shows you how variable your glucose is, so how high it goes, how low it goes. Because what we do know is when people have issues with low glucose levels, that creates an oxidative stress. And that oxidative stress creates an adrenaline and cortisol shift. And it's like it's a physiological stressor on the body, and it's associated with increased risk of cardiovascular disease. So knowing someone's glucose variability, and you can see people with normal hemoglobin A1Cs and impaired glucose variability, and you can work on that stability of their glucose to make a big impact on their cardiovascular risk. And it was found also that, you know, by changing that diet and lifestyle using CGMs actually impacted the hemoglobin A1C levels and reduced the microvascular complications of cardiometabolic disease.
I have to agree with you. CGMs I find extremely useful from a compliance aspect. I tend to use them a lot with my patients that, you know, look at me a bit skeptically when I'm asking them to make dietary changes, and I know they need some data and some evidence about what's going on with the decision in the moment. And I would agree, you know, 9 times out of 10, they come back and they have made behavioural changes because they've seen the data. So a really great tool, Michelle. Thanks for bringing that one up. Lisa, your turn. Are there any blood tests that you find particularly useful?
Yeah, so I really love to do the simple blood test for homocysteine. We know that homocysteine is a sulfur-containing amino acid formed during breakdown of methionine. High levels of homocysteine can induce endothelial cell damage, promote and release inflammatory factors, stimulate oxidative stress, and they can also it can also increase thrombosis. So in terms of minimising cardiometabolic risk, testing for homocysteine is really important, as it seems that people with an elevated homocysteine level have about twice the risk of coronary artery disease than those with a normal level. High homocysteine is also associated with increased risk of stroke and heart attack, probably because of that thrombosis issue too. So for me, it's a no-brainer to do. It's free. I do get a little bit of pushback, but I think it's a really important one because in so many patients that I test, it comes up elevated. The other thing that I like to test is insulin. So as Adrian mentioned, there's a strong relationship between insulin and cortisol. And I think often patients are having their serum glucose and their HbA1c being measured, but actually those can be normal, but they can still be insulin resistant. So for me, it points to more of that stress kind of cortisol picture. And I loved what Michelle was saying about hostility. That can then, you know, develop where we apply our prescription. Maybe they need more work around that stress adaptation. The other thing that I love to test, of course, is thyroid function, because hypothyroidism can be the root cause of that dyslipidemia. And so there I'll see high total cholesterol and high LDL, but usually the triglycerides will be normal. So when I test the thyroid and the T3 is too low, I know that that's the cause of the cardiometabolic syndrome, or one kind of cause, rather than it being a diet factor.
What I'm loving about this conversation already is how wide this conversation of cardiometabolic health goes. You've just talked about insulin, homocysteine and thyroid, all as being important tests, and they are, but it's like, it's a huge topic. So yes. Thank you for cherry picking your favourites on that level. Mick, what are you seeing on the pharmacy landscape for assessment?
Well, pharmacies have always been a traditional place where people have done some kind of screening for their cardiometabolic health, but they've moved a long way from simply testing for things like blood pressure and height and weight. And this is because there have been advances in technology that have made these modern tests more efficient, cost-effective, portable and practical. So pharmacies now can screen for everything from blood pressure, BMI and heart rate, HbA1c and glucose monitoring to many lipid panels. And this is known as point-of-care testing. And in many cases, pharmacies test for free. So, you know, you don't know what your pharmacy may be capable of doing unless you ask them. So it might be worth your while if people want to ask about that. But really, these point-of-care tests are the ones that I tend to prefer. They're fairly easy and comprehensive and quick. They only take around about 10 minutes. We do the HbA1c and we also do a little mini lipid panel. It's not fasting, so it's not perfect, but we can allow for people when they've eaten. We know that if someone's eaten and their triglycerides are sitting still around sort of 2.5, etc., then we have to make an assumption that usually their triglycerides would be okay. Interestingly, there was a group of pharmacies that ran a trial of this point-of-care testing earlier this year, and the patient feedback was overwhelmingly positive about that, but there were some surprises. I spoke to the people that did it, and they said in one location, over 20% of the people that sat down and tested either had raised HbA1c levels that they weren't aware of, or elevated triglycerides, or lipids. So it was a bit of a shock for some of those people. It'll be interesting to see if this becomes a standard service in the pharmacy landscape in the future, though. One of the largest data sets that we have about our national cardiometabolic health actually comes from a company that owns a pharmacy wholesaler. It comprises de-identified data from around 3 million digital health checks across 500 locations. Now, they've compiled this data anywhere from 2018 to 2014, so it's a pretty large data set there as well. And so we can see pre- and post-COVID information. And the numbers are quite interesting. Our obesity rates increased from 25% pre-COVID to 27% at the height of COVID. The good news is that it's starting to come back down. They've only just reached 26% in late 2024. There's been really high rates of increases in blood pressure. This is nationally. They were reducing before COVID, so there was a downward trend before COVID. But since then, they've gone up and remained high with no return. So that's not great. Mm. The OSD risk tool there's one of the questionnaires on this device, this health station asks about OSD risk, and it's shown that 38% of the people that were tested between the ages of 25 and 74 are at high risk of type 2 diabetes. But some of these other stats link into some of the things other people have been saying in this conversation. 13% of us are still daily smokers, with the highest rates of smoking between 16 to 34-year-olds. And that's a bit shocking. It's also interesting, when people sit down on these machines, you say, there's a question that says, do you smoke? And then they go, well, I vape. Mm-hmm. And they don't really correlate vaping with smoking, which is, I find, mind-boggling, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Also, uncontrolled blood pressure, as I mentioned before, is high and sits at around 20% of the population tested. I was going to just add one thing in relation to what Lisa mentioned before about poor level of health literacy, and I do see it with people that sit down on these machines. They're a little bit unaware of what's a healthy blood pressure or what's a healthy, say, level of HDL, etc. But there was research carried out by the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington School of Medicine. Now, this was reported recently in The Lancet only as little as a week or two ago. And this was in partnership with some international collaborators. They examined diabetes care across all age groups and sexes in 204 countries and territories between 2002 and 2023. The analysis found 44% of individuals aged 15 and older with diabetes didn't even know that they had the condition. Mm. So it was pretty frightening.
Wow, Mick, that's shocking to me. And I guess this really highlights the role of community pharmacy. And I think this is a good point for all of us to reach out to our local community pharmacies and see what kind of point of testing they do, because at least this is screening people to then, you know, send them to the right person, to the GP, and get them in front of the right person. So that's a very interesting insight. Adrian, how do you assess cardiometabolic health?
Yes, I mean, I'll continue to talk on the stress mental health theme, obviously, as a psychologist, but certainly I think one of the things that we need to do is, you know, due to the strong relationship between mood and stress and heart disease, it's really important to assess for people's mental health state and their emotional coping skills. So, you know, definitely assessing for things like depression, anxiety and other mental health conditions, even things like ADHD and you know, certainly PTSD and those conditions are important to assess for, because we know that they can have an impact on our cardiometabolic health. So you can do that through, obviously, interviews and questionnaires and ask about past history and ask about current stresses and asking them how they cope, you know, what are their coping skills like? When they're stressed, how do they manage that stress? What do they do? What happens when they're stressed? What happens to their lifestyle? What happens to their diet? How does their social interactions change when they're experiencing stress? You know, Michelle mentioned earlier, you know, that often people don't know, you know, when you use the word stress, you know, she mentioned obviously hostility. And certainly I think one of the things that we need to do is find out how in tune people are to their body and to, you know, their stress response. You know, do they know when their body is stressed? Do they notice things like, you know, often the symptoms obviously include, you know, heart palpitations and headaches and digestive symptoms and brain fog. And often people don't correlate that with stress. So I think certainly asking about those symptoms and finding out about when they occur, what time of the day they occur, what triggers there are, and I think those things are really, really important. And again, you know, with regards to what Michelle said, it popped in my head that I did read a paper about continuous glucose monitoring, and there was one study that I saw, and you know, there's flaws with it, but certainly that the I think that it was like the time in range or something was associated with a better mood based upon the continuous glucose monitoring. So they're things that are really important to assess for. Obviously, sleep quality. We know the importance of sleep on overall health and you know, asking about their sleep and using questionnaires and sleep trackers and diaries. And then we can also potentially measure cortisol. So I mentioned earlier about cortisol. You can measure that through, obviously, blood, but, you know, blood's probably more around measuring things like, you know, Cushing's and Addison's disease, but you can certainly do salivary measures, which include measures throughout the day and, you know, cortisol awakening response and different options you have there. You can measure it now through hair, and that gives more of a chronic measure of cortisol output. And, you know, they're definitely things that we have available, options we have available to us.
Thank you so much, Adrian. So zooming back out on an assessment summary, I really love the waist measurement and the body roundness index. Michelle, your favourite was the CGM, in particular for the compliance it can create, which I concur with. Lisa highlighted the usefulness of testing insulin, thyroid markers and homocysteine. Mick, you gave us a fantastic reminder on the role of community pharmacy in point of care testing. And then Adrian explored the role of mood-based questionnaires and appropriate cortisol testing to assess cardiometabolic health. Before I go any further, though, a reminder that you can find all the show notes, transcripts and other resources from today's episode on the FX Medicine by Bioceuticals website. Now, there is a huge category we haven't yet discussed when it comes to metabolic health. These are the factors that can hijack different body systems and produce comorbidities. We knew this topic would be complex when we brainstormed this episode, but the reality is that cardiometabolic health can be sabotaged without us realizing it. Let's look at some common cardiometabolic hijackers. Michelle, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a great question, isn't it? Because it really lends into that holistic approach, you know, that's so required in human health. But I think it's really important to understand the role of early childhood trauma. Adrian mentioned it before. These adverse childhood events can really set people up for significant lifelong chronic disease risk. And I mean that in a risks, because it's not like a lay down mazea, but there is some significant issues with adverse childhood events. And those that had four adverse events in childhood had a 59% increased risk of cardiovascular disease across their lifetime. Wow. And these events are kind of things like, you know, neglect or childhood trauma, whether it's sexual, emotional, physical, incarceration of an adult, mental health disease, you know, in an adult. And across the board, when they studied a huge number of people and put together this questionnaire, found that about 69% had, you know, at least one of these adverse childhood events. And so that's a significant number of people in the population, and it's really worth highlighting for practitioners as well to really have, I guess, an empathy to what people do carry from their childhood, and to really work in bringing in that psychological lens to this kind of physical condition. The other thing that I want to highlight, which is growing, which is really sad and a sad indictment of our society, is loneliness. Mm. And loneliness used to be a condition kind of reserved for the elderly. But now we're seeing loneliness in young people. And in fact, about 25% of our young people from the age of 18 to 25 report loneliness, despite this kind of hyperconnective world we live in. And loneliness is the condition of not feeling understood, or not feeling like you have somebody that could potentially understand you. And I think that that's a really important role for practitioners to ask about, because we know loneliness is actually a stronger risk factor for cardiovascular disease than smoking is, which is just alarming, because it actually speaks volumes about the physiological impact of loneliness at a cellular level. And really also highlights this sort of real importance of community medicine, of social medicine and social prescribing, and such a beautiful way, because not only if you can help somebody manage loneliness, you really help them build more of a quality of life. And the other hijacker that I think is really important to highlight is the role of, well, psychoneuroendocrinology. And so what we know with the changes, particularly of both men and women, but women experience a menopause, whereas men tend to have a loss of hormones at a later age, around kind of 60 to 65. And that loss of estrogen, progesterone, testosterone have huge implications and changes to the cardiometabolic system. And what women, you know, often naturally kind of find out for themselves around menopause is that there's a tendency to lose muscle and put on weight because of those metabolic changes. Mm. And it's on average women put around 8 to 10 kilos over that 10-year sort of perimenopausal span. And that has significant implications for dyslipidemia and cholesterol accumulation, which therefore has that flow-on effect. And so, you know, if you think about what progesterone does too, it actually tends to support things like sleep and smooth muscle relaxation and the cardiovascular system, and it tends to lower blood pressure. So when you're having a drop of that, that also has that kind of side impact on the cardiometabolic system.
I love the highlight on loneliness there. Frightening, as you say, but it seems the more connected we are digitally, the less connected we are as humans, which is a very sad thing. But I just rang Probus last week for a 78-year-old patient that I felt was lonely, and so I connected her with her local Probus. So there's things that we can do to really help in that space.
How beautiful.
Yeah. Adrian, it's your turn. Can you tell us about the link between cardiometabolic health and mental health?
Yeah, certainly. Keep that theme going. So certainly, you know, the research consistently shows, you know, I've already mentioned some of the, you know, the relationship between mental health and cardiometabolic health, but I'll just go through some of the stats, you know, with regard to that. So, Yeah, with depression, there's a meta-analysis of 26 studies and almost 2 million people, and they found that depression was associated with increased risk of stroke, 13% increased risk, myocardial infarction was 28%, and congestive heart failure mortality was 3.2 times greater risk if you had depression. So definitely a strong link between depression and cardiovascular health. Insomnia, certainly patients with insomnia have a 45% higher risk of developing cardiovascular disease. It's associated with, obviously, insomnia and obstructive sleep apnea, certainly associated with cardiovascular risk and impaired glucose tolerance. Meta-analysis of 90,000 people showed a 28% increased risk of developing diabetes in people with short sleep. PTSD is another one. 20 studies over 330,000 people, 1.4 times increased risk. And the other one, interestingly, is ADHD. So even ADHD, they followed up people for almost 12 years, and it was about 5 million people that they followed up as a Swedish national population study. And they followed up for almost 12 years. And what they found was certainly 33% of individuals with ADHD had at least one diagnosis of cardiovascular disease versus about 20% in those without ADHD. So that's another thing to consider is, somebody presenting with ADHD, we know that they also have an increased risk of cardiovascular disease, and we really need to assess that. And finally, just the other one is, personality types. Certainly there's research there around different personality types in cardiovascular disease. You've got your type A type personality where people are driven and competitive, impatient, but then you also got research around type D personality, which is more associated with being distressed and socially inhibited, and they're all linked with a greater risk of cardiovascular disease.
That's a lot of risk in a couple of minutes there, Adrian. Once again, the statistics are frightening. Now, if you're listening, it's not all doom and gloom. We will be providing solutions as well, but we do have to face the facts. Mick, you have some really great insights from that pharmaceutical side of things. What are your thoughts here?
Yeah, well, medications are among the most prolific culprits of hijacking our metabolic health. Things, if we have a look at some really common medications, psychotropics, for example, particularly things like olanzapine and quetiapine. Psychotropics like olanzapine can add as much as 2.4 kilos to someone's weight. Quetiapine can add as much as 1.2 kilograms in weight, and this is over a period of 3 months. If we look at things like gabapentin, has been associated with around about 2.2 kilograms of weight gain over a period of 1.5 months. Tricyclic antidepressants like amitriptyline can add as much as 1.8 kilos to an average person, and mirtazapine can add 1.5 kilograms. I should really qualify this by saying this will be dose dependent. Now, if we've got patients where they've been on these medications for a period of time, they're not going to suddenly jump up in weight either. And the process by which these have this effect is they dysregulate appetite control. They increase ghrelin and leptin levels. This effectively increases hunger and reduces satiety. And they end up producing or having increases in pro-inflammatory cytokines like TNF-alpha, and they can exacerbate insulin resistance. They can also stimulate cholesterol synthesis. Now, traditionally, hypoglycemic drugs have added weight to people as well, upwards of 3 kilograms to people over the years. But newer medications like GLP-1 receptor agonists, etc., have addressed that issue. We can see the level that they're used now. Beta blockers, things like metoprolol, they can cause issues with poor sugar metabolism and they are associated with some abdominal fat accumulation. And corticosteroids traditionally have added a little bit of weight to people, but also antiretroviral therapies, things like protease inhibitors that are used in HIV, etc., they have been implicated in visceral fat accumulation, insulin resistance and dyslipidemia. So there are a plethora of medications that can hijack your cardiometabolic health.
And just a thought in my head then is we really have to triple check what medications our patients are taking, because sometimes they've been on something for so long, they just simply omit it because they just don't remember it. So a caveat there, just please make sure you're double checking what your patients are taking. Lisa, as naturopaths, we just can't go past the role of the gut microbiome. What came to mind for you?
Well, we know that the gut bacteria are involved in absolutely everything, and this includes cardiometabolic health. So dysbiosis, both of the gastrointestinal tract, but definitely in the oral cavity, have been linked to the development of cardiometabolic diseases, including hypertension, diabetes, and obesity. Now, this is thought to be due to the ability of the gut bacteria to modulate inflammation, improve insulin sensitivity and cholesterol levels. And of course, in dysbiosis, we're going to see the opposite of this. So how do the bacteria do this? Well, it's complicated. There are many mechanisms, but let me explain just a few. So we know from speaking to our podcast guest, Dr. Brad Leach, who's been on a few times, that dysbiosis can cause intestinal hyperpermeability. And intestinal hyperpermeability and dysbiosis not only create inflammation, they increase systemic inflammation. This low-grade systemic inflammation actually drives cardiometabolic disease, which is not something I knew before I spoke to Brad. Now, the actual gut microbiota themselves have the capacity to alter blood lipid composition, in particular cholesterol, through their role in bile acid metabolism. And additionally, the gut bacteria themselves can release inflammatory metabolites. For example, trimethylamine N-oxide, TMAO, which is a metabolite produced by the bacteria from dietary choline and carnitine. And elevated levels have been linked to increased risk of cardiovascular disease, including atherosclerosis and heart failure. So anyone doing gut testing will be familiar with TMAO, as it's a metabolite you can test for via the stool. So it helps us identify this risk of cardiovascular disease in our patients. Now, it's not all bad news. I know we're going to talk about what we can do in the next episode, but I just wanted to say, of course, we all know as prackies we can modify the microbiome, and results from a 2024 Framingham Heart Study observed that species from the Oscillobacter genus were associated with decreased fecal and plasma cholesterol levels. So we know if we modify that gut microbiome, then we can modify cardiometabolic disease risk.
Thanks, Lisa. What a good refresher that was on the microbiome and inflammation and dysbiosis. So a quick summary here of the hijackers. Michelle mentioned the role of early childhood trauma, plus don't forget the effect of changing hormones as we age. Adrian covered the impact of mental health, and I like that little kind of info about the personality types. Mick reminded us of how specific classes of medication negatively impact our cardiometabolic health. And then Lisa, you discussed the role of gut dysbiosis and inflammation. The last thing I would love from each of you before we close out for this discussion was, what is the one thing that stood out for you today? Lisa, how about you go first?
For me, Michelle's insights into hostility were really profound and tie in really nicely with what I see in clinic around high cortisol and stress and that impacting cardiometabolic disease. I think often patients come in and they're very focused on the diet aspect, but they don't understand just how important that psychological element is.
Thank you. Michelle, what was your one highlight?
Oh, wow. It was such a good discussion, you know, to really show just how many factors impact these really important systems. And also like taking a really broad lens and looking really widely at people as a whole, I think is super important. And I loved also how many different practitioners, even though they look at it differently, they're coming to that same sort of person-centric response to this really important disease.
Patient-centered medicine, absolutely. Adrian, what was your one highlight?
Yeah, I think, it really just highlights that as health practitioners, we're on the right track, you know, in terms of integrative health practitioners, we're on the right track. I mean, there's so many variables that affect our cardiometabolic health, and we need to be holistic in our approach, and certainly that's highlighted by the discussion today.
Thank you. And Mick, to finish us off today, what's your one highlight?
Well, I like the body roundness index. I thought that was a really good a little tool that you can use. And I also liked Michelle's comment about glucose variability. I know, I've traditionally seen people with diabetes use CGMs, but I do know that every now and again someone comes in that uses it for their general health. And I love the fact that variability is more, seems to give us different information to just a HbA1c. Like you said, it's just a snapshot. So, yeah, I took those away.
Brilliant. Thanks for sharing, everybody. We will see you next time.
Bye, thanks, Emma. Sam. Bye,
thanks.
Everyone.
Bye.
Thanks.
Today in part one, we busted some myths, covered the pathophysiology involved in cardiometabolic disease, the assessment measures we use in our own clinics, and finished by highlighting key cardiometabolic hijackers. Next week in part two, we'll discuss treatment options, not only traditional treatment options, but also the treatments each of us have discovered through our clinical expertise and bring these to life via a case study. We will end with our favourite resources to use with patients. Thank you everyone for listening today. Don't forget that you can find all the show notes, transcripts and other resources from today's episode on the FX Medicine by Bioceuticals website. I'm Emma Sutherland. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. This podcast is intended as healthcare practitioner education only, and it is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to FX Medicine, and share us with your family, friends, and colleagues.